You work for a consulting service, is that what it is, Mike?
Negative. Direct federal government.
Are we allowed to know what branch of the government?
Yes, the Veterans Administration. That one I can talk about.
Okay. Sounds like you get involved in some pretty wild projects. Weren't you doing a whole lot of work in the New York City metropolitan area recently?
Yeah, I was involved in New York City schools. Well, that's those contracts dried up, and I got this federal job, which I'm very, very happy with. And the challenges are really fascinating that I have today.
Are most of them RF-oriented challenges?
Well, some are, let's see, I got a fire damper project, which is, you know, life safety. I have a alarm system, which is electronic. I have cabling projects that I have to do. I also have a window project. We do it all. Our engineering department, we do it all.
Sounds good, Mike. Okay. I think the next person on our list was Wes. N2XJN, go ahead with your question or comment, Wes, K2RIW.
Dick, N2EO, could you put me in there last? I came into the net late. Thank you.
You're on the list. Go ahead, Wes.
It is a question. So, we have electromagnetic wave. We can feed that wave in form of TEM, at TE or TM mode, into the waveguide. Or we can feed it to the interface. That would be more familiar name for that wave. That would be surface wave. That is in interface. Let me jump.
By the way, most signals you send down a waveguide for the lowest frequency dominant mode is almost always TE. Very rarely do we launch a TM wave in waveguide, unless it's a very special application. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
I do thank you for that. So, talking about the interface in physics, a surface wave is a 90-degree wave that is that propagates along the interface between different media. And if we, well, one of the examples would be the gravitational wave, but if we're talking about the electromagnetic wave, and that would be the electromagnetic wave can also propagate as surface wave in that they can be guided along a refractive index gradient or along interface between two media having different dielectric constant. Let me drop. So we have a different kinds of interface, and it could be plastic, dead Teflon, let's say, with that has a certain dielectric constant with polyamide that has a different dielectric constant, and you put one on the top of the other, and then you have your interface. That differs from the waveguide, definitely. You may have a conductive medium, which would be a aluminum foil, and your dielectric would be an air, and that makes interface. Let me drop. You may have also a air, which is now lossy conducting medium, and air, which is a dielectric, and that substitute that makes also a two different media that creates an interface and having different dielectric constants. Now there is something that I would like to ask you for, which is, what is the behavior of TEM in TE mode, let's say, because you said that it's mostly in waveguides, not TM. And TEM, behavior in the interface, mostly in TM mode? And also, can we say, could that be proper, let me drop, to say that two different media with different, having different dielectric constant, when we have the interface made from aluminum foil and air as a dielectric, could we say that aluminum foil is different conducting media? Because if we have any other conductor that is not as good as aluminum or copper, let's say earth, then it's lossy conductive medium. Could we say that lossy dielectric or lossy conductive is actually the same, only differently named? So wave behavior is what I'm interested with. Thank you.
One of the things you were discussing is a surface wave on a sheet of aluminum foil. First of all, why would you want to launch a surface wave on a sheet of aluminum foil? Over to you, Wes.
If you want to send energy from point A to point B at any given distance, then you need to have either waveguide or you need to have a interface. And if the interface is made not from two different dielectrics, that means, let's say, polyamide and Teflon, but is made from conductive media, which is a aluminum foil or copper foil, and then your dielectric is air, and that makes interface, then you are able to do so. So for me, important, because I want to send energy from point A to point B, whether it is 80 meters, or that is 10 feet, or that is 1,000 feet, and to XGN. So my question was wave behavior, how wave behavior differs between the wave sent through the waveguide, rectangular waveguide, let's say, or the wave that is sent through the interface. And to XGN.
If you try to send energy from point A to point B, and if you're doing it at a frequency where waveguide is appropriate, waveguide is great stuff up to, let me pick a number, 100 feet. If you're going a couple hundred feet, you'll be very disappointed with waveguide. At X-band, for instance, waveguide has got a loss of 4.5 dB per 100 feet. If it's perfectly brand new, clean, dry nitrogen filled, and so on, you go a couple of hundred feet with waveguide at X-band, you've only got 10% of your energy left. So waveguide, the good news is it's beautifully shielded. The bad news is it's very lossy when there's any distance involved. And the loss is some number of decibels per foot. The loss is linear, not exponential. In the case of free space propagation, the signal is exponential, which sounds worse. It's really better. You only lose 6 dB every time you double the distance. When you start talking about a very long distance, the doubling is still a very big number in distance, and therefore the loss is tolerable. The example I gave once of sending an X-band signal to the moon by waveguide or free space, and the difference is huge. The free space signal gets there thousands of dB stronger than if you use the world's most perfect waveguide. So as I said, waveguide is good if you're not using a lot of it. So, what medium by which are you going to transmit a signal? If you've got a long distance to send a signal, the best thing I can think of is so-called beam waveguide. In other words, you've got a high-gain dish aiming the signal like a flashlight beam at your point of reception, and you've got a similar signal receiving system in order to get it there. Free space through air with a beam waveguide can give you a tolerable loss over a long distance where you would not use waveguide. And one of the things you'd like to know about the waveguide itself, let me drop. The waveguide, the coax adapter, if you look at it, you see a piece of waveguide where roughly a quarter wavelength from the shielded end, you see a little wire that goes to the center conductor of your type-in end connector, for instance. That really is a monopole antenna. There's a small, capacitively loaded monopole antenna inside of a waveguide, the coax adapter, that's launching a vertically polarized signal into that waveguide. And so that signal then bounces down the waveguide by going back and forth between the narrow walls is where the bounce is taking place, and only propagates a fraction of an inch on each bounce at X-band. And so there's a zillion bounces for any reasonable distance. That's why you get an awful lot of loss in waveguides. So when it comes to microwave frequencies and long distances for sending energy, you got to be very careful as to what medium you choose. An awful lot of the common sense medium, coax and waveguide, usually is the darn lossy that you probably don't want to do it that way. Maybe that helps a little bit. N2XJN, K2IW.
What I wanted to know is, what is the difference of behavior of electromagnetic wave in waveguide versus the same wave in interface? A few words so we are on the same page. If you have a vertical antenna, sort of like the antenna that you have on your car, and you, or you have a Tesla coil, whatever it is, and then you have a situation at which you put on the top of the Tesla coil the one plate of the capacitor, which would be a one rectangular way or just a torus whatsoever. That plate would be your earth, and that makes a capacitor. But this structure makes the sending wave. Let me jump. Now, your TEM, if you want to fit it into the interface, and that would be two pieces of plastic, 10 feet long, 20 feet long, or that would be metal or and air, or that would be earth and air, that would be your interface. If something that is being called Brewster angle, you can Google it, Brewster, B-R-E-W-S-T-E-R angle. And that angle is the angle of incident at which electromagnetic wave, that could be light, that could be any wave, with a particular polarization is perfectly transmitted on the surface of that dielectric and has no reflection. Let me jump. So when unpolarized electromagnetic wave is incident at this angle, that electromagnetic wave is reflected from the surface and therefore perfectly polarized. So what I'm saying is, the means of feeding interface versus the means of feeding a waveguide are a little different. Wave tilt at the Brewster angle is usually full red tape frequency, 1.1 megahertz would be 65, 67 degrees. And you got to understand one thing, this wave is not radiating. It doesn't radiate. You cannot see that wave in the far field. It doesn't exist. So that's the way we feed. And there is a perfect, a very much scientific video that I can send you a link to, which explains, if you put the in YouTube surface wave, you're going to get the video that explains different kind of surface waves in the strip, microstrip, or in the interface. So that's the explanation. I was in hope that you know that subject about the interfaces.
I have some understanding of the Brewster angle for a vertically polarized signal reflecting off of a partially reflecting surface, and why the Brewster angle is where the reflection goes to zero for a purely vertically polarized wave. And then you're saying that you could use this as a mechanism for launching a surface wave into that surface. Why do you want to do that? How far away do you want that wave to go? What do you intend to do with that wave? That you think you've launched a surface wave into a dielectric medium. Why do you want to do that? What good does it do for you, Wes? Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm interested with sending energy from point A to point B. That could be 10 feet, that could be 10,000 feet, and that could be around the Earth. The good thing about interface is that interface could be bended into different shape, and the wave that is trapped into the walls of that interface, and that could be two different dielectrics, or that could be air and metal, or that could be air and earth, will go along the surface of or curvature of that interface.
In the past, you've talked about using the ionosphere and the Earth as a kind of vertically displaced waveguide and launching a signal into that. And yes, you can launch a signal, but typical of sending an HF wave through the medium, through air and ionosphere, you're going to get tremendous losses. I mean, you're sending out signals of a kilowatt, and the guy on the other end gets a signal of a microvolt. So you're not going to send a substantial amount of energy this way. I mean, Tesla thought he would be sending power wirelessly, and that he would get, he was hoping he would get 90% of the power at the other end. He's going to get 0.0000001 of the power at the other end. It's not very useful. He didn't realize the inverse square law characteristics that he's still fighting. So therefore, is this really useful? Can you do anything with it? Can you send any substantial amount of power? Can you send a signal that a supersensitive receiver can receive? Yes. So therefore, you can send information. But you can't send real energy and power by these means, as I see it, Wes. You can't send a substantial amount of energy and recover it by these techniques. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, if you depends from the form at which you want to send the energy from point A to point B. The losses are extremely small if we're using interface at low frequencies. The lower the frequency, the better the performance. And we're coming to the area that is questionable because we have $1 billion right now investment in Tesla Tower by a company in Texas and Visiv, and they built that. $500 million was invested into just the structure. And that structure is using air interface to send energy from point A to B. The effectiveness, if we could use the word effectiveness, would be 93% to 97%, even to 98% of the real power from the other side. The problem that that Visiv has right now is the system is reactive. So since we're dealing with non-radiating wave, it is that FCC gave the license to them, and they proved that, yes, it's a huge amount of power, and about 1 kilowatt, and it is not radiating beyond the near field. I mean, you may say that in the Fresnel zone, you may see something, but in the far field, you have nothing. Let me jump.
Are you saying there's a company in Texas establishing a very large Tesla-like tower, and he wants to use it for transmitting energy from point A to point B over some substantial distance, like miles, and there's $1 million or even more already invested in this project, and they expect to get 90% efficiency? Boy, there's a lot of assumptions here.
Well, Dick, it's not $1 million, it's $1 billion. The company, the Jewish Chevron, seeing that soon, and it's probably going to be year 2024, 4, they will face a serious crisis because of that system. So in other words, Dr. Corum, James Corum, you can Google it. He owns over 200 patents. He is doing patents like crazy. In 2013, he got a cross Chevron, and they start to look at what they have. Let me jump.
What's his definition of success? Sending radio electric energy over some number of miles in a wireless manner using this huge tower on each end? Is that his definition of the project?
The definition of the project is send electrical energy to any point in the earth. The company is going as crazy, in crazy speed right now. They make patent in approximately one patent per week. All of the patents are owned by Corum Brothers. There is a Kenneth Corum, who is much smarter than Dr. James Corum, and the tower was ready in January of this year, and they said that the end of the year they're going to have a first power transmission to another continent. Let me drop.
I think they're likely to be very disappointed.
Well, I thought they stood until my friend Dr. Hans, who was more of a skeptic than Dr. Roy, decided to fight with me, and he made it happen. So I've got the confirmation. I saw the confirmation. The energy was sent from point A to point B at a distance of 6 miles and to XGN.
They sent energy at what frequency over 6 miles? How much energy? And what was the percentage that got there? How big was the tower on each end? Go ahead.
We were trying to repeat Dr. James Gorham, Seneca Lake. The story is 1933, Seneca Lake. Dr. Zenek at 1908 made a serious discovery, and in 1933 the discovery was conquered, and one of the scientists found that there is an error in math, and Zenek wave cannot work in the interface. Let me drop. I'm going to give you more. So Dr. Corum decided to use the same Seneca Lake, upstate New York, and in assistance of Chevron, they repeated and then proved that there was no error in math, and Seneca wave is able to be fed into the interface. By that, it is able to be transmitted. So they were able to the length of the Seneca Lake. I don't remember. Is it 10 kilometers? But it's quite long. They were able to send milliwatts and receive from the other side using Seneca wave in the interface. That would be air and water. Or the same energy with 2-3% of the losses. When I was doing the experiment with Dr. Hans, we had about 25% of losses. The power was 40 watts. And that was 6 miles, this stuff, and to XGN.
Are you saying that you worked on a project where you sent power over 6 miles and a high percentage of it got there? What frequency? How did you do that? Go ahead.
The frequency was approximately 260, 280 kilohertz, and we used two Tesla coils. One Tesla coil was at point A, the other one was at point B. The distance was approximately 6 miles. The interface was earth-air, and to XGN.
So you sent 40 watts over 6 miles with two Tesla coils. you personally did that and confirmed the results? Go ahead. I'm very skeptical.
No, that was my friend, Dr. Hans, who did it. I was the assistant of his. And yes, you can be skeptical. I don't fight with that. And that's what I admire in Dr. Roy, that he's skeptical. And to Exxon, so the losses were approximately 25%. And to Exxon.
So 75% of the power got there wirelessly over a 6-mile distance. How were you receiving the power? How did he receive the power? How did he confirm what power he received?
The same way that Visiv did. You have a reactive system. You're feeding, you have a vertical structure, you're feeding this structure with the generator. You don't have to have a generator, you can have a spark gap. Now, if you look at the envelope of spark gap, then it's much easier to do because it starts from a single hertz and ends up in 1.2 gigahertz. Now, if your peak of frequencies at very wide of it is at 200 kilohertz, let's say, if your Tesla coil is not exactly tuned or is using the tuning, any adjacent frequency from the frequency of the previous resonance would work. If you now put your Tesla coil on the other side, and your Tesla coil will then be reverse connected to the load, and you tune it to the resonance, and you have an impedance match, you have the receiving structure. And that's exactly what is in over 200 patterns, because every pattern has also the beginning of it. So if the pattern is related to securing the electricity to be not against the theft, let me drop it. Because they have such a one, and that's the polyphase. They use polyphase. So they, instead of sending just one phase, they sending 10 phases or 20 phases. And the code of the relation between the phases in the transmitter is sent every 2 seconds, because this doesn't have to be only used for the energy send it, but could be used for communication, it could be used for surveillance, it could be used for monitoring or switching on and off devices based on your choice. So you can switch the customer, switch off customer microwave, leaving the customer light in the living room still operating. So this is, but that pattern also has the previous 20 pages, let me drop, of the basic information from the very first pattern at 2013. So I was looking for the confirmation of whether this is a hoax for $1 billion, not $1 million, $1 billion, that Chevron was vulnerable to. Or it is a real working device. The problem of Visiv is because it's reactive. So if whatever happened to the load on the receiver side, it is affecting the transmitter. So if you have a reflected wave, because of a sudden you have an impedance mismatch or you have a short, then that energy is going to be bouncing back. The difference of the wave in the interface between the wave that is in space and could travel without the restriction is that once you place electromagnetic wave out of your transmitter, it can travel forever, and you can switch off the transmitter. In the TM mode of TEM, in the interface, when you switch off the transmitter, you don't have anything in the interface. It's like never was there. It's like the potential in your outlet that you have on the wall. And if you have an impedance matching device to receive it, and with their coding, you have a proper code for encoding, you can take that energy from another Tesla coil and to XGA.
I've heard enough, and I'm not interested. I see no commercial value in this. I mean, if he intends to send power to a city, how do the individual people get charged for the amount that he used? Are they really going to receive it? This doesn't sound like a viable thing. I don't care if there's a million patents. I don't care if there's $1 billion invested. I've got a high, strong feeling that this thing is a hoax. Very similar to what Tesla was trying to do. Tesla was a brilliant guy, and he had some very good projects. This particular project of his, was a boondoggle. It didn't stand a chance. And now we have another person a century later trying to do it again. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. I don't think the people tuning into the TechNet want to hear anymore.
No, I understand that. I'm not going to continue. I was asking you the question about the behavior of the electromagnetic wave in the interface. I wanted more information to be given. I didn't want even to discuss that. So let's say I never discussed it with you. Would you please tell me what is the difference of behavior of electromagnetic wave in the interface, as this is proven, versus the waveguide?
I don't understand the question, therefore I don't stand a chance of answering it.
N2EO.
Let's go over to the next person. N2EO, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, let me say this. What you just said, I understand. Nobody wants to hear it. It's crackpot nonsense. I'm sorry, Wesley, but that's what it is. It's crackpot stuff. I don't want to hear it, and I don't think anybody else wants to hear it either. Dick, can I go on with my subject?
I just passed it to you.
Okay, Dick. I'm almost done computerizing my entire ham station. And first of all, I used to think the software control program for the Kenwood equipment, I don't know, I assumed I had to buy it and there was an interface. Not so. I check into a group at night on 3919. They call themselves a friendly group. Nice group of people. One of them in Western Pennsylvania, I don't remember his call, name is Martin. He told me the software is free. You just hook it up with a USB cable from your radio up to the computer. It works like a charm. Anyway, that software for the TS-590SG that I have, they also have software for the Kenwood TS-2000. And I'm going to have a drop. On both radios is a firmware upgrade. It's free. That's all they're doing to get it in there because you first have to go to another site and download a virtual driver. Once that's installed, you upload the software, upload the upgrade to your radio. It goes in perfectly. First time. There's a good reason to upgrade the firmware on the TS-2000 and what I have, the TS-590. Originally, there's a jack on the back that's marked drive. It's made to be used with transverters. On the later version of the software, you can select drive or receive antenna. And the reason you want to select receive antenna, you could buy a SDR receiver, a small package, they're made in England, sold here, they're $150. It connects with an SMA cable. I don't know why they use SMA connector. to the receiver. And from there, use an Ethernet cable over to your computer. It comes with software that you load. And then you load a free package, all free, that will give you a spectrum scope on your radio. You have it on the computer, a large screen spectrum scope. I watch the information on YouTube. It's gorgeous. I'm going to reset. Alright. On the TS-2000, it's a little different. There's a guy in the Midwest, I didn't hear who, like, went over the demonstration very quickly. He makes a SDR receiver board and also a buffer board for the IF. It's a no-holes modification. Everything goes down with double-stick tape on the left side and the right side of the main board. He unplugs the second IF jack. He plugs it into the buffer board. I'm not sure what he does afterwards, but somehow it gets into the SDR receiver. He does that because he doesn't want to load the IF. And that works wonderful. No holes, completely removable. He brings a cable out of the back where it slits in the back, already there. It's well worth the effort.
If I understand you correctly, Rich, you've done all this and you're pleased with the results. You've now got computer control of your ham radio equipment. Go ahead.
I have everything else but the SDR radio. I'll buy it next month. I have a lot of bills, household expenses this month. But I have the interface running for the TS-590, the Kenwood interface, and I have a program I got running. It's called D-RAT, R-A-T, D-RAT. It's for use with D-STAR, with D-STAR and the D-RAT program, you know, you can not only talk over D-STAR, but you can send messages. That's the nice part. And it goes out at 9600 baud.
Rich, what's the main reason why you want your ham radio equipment to be computer controlled? What do you gain by doing that? Is this just for D-STAR operation?
No, it's for everything operation. In my case, Dick, I don't see well, and my hand tremor. It's much easier to use the buttons for me on the computer because I can see them better than I can on the radio. I can tune with the mouse, up, down. It does all kinds of things I like. It's good for anybody, but especially people with disabilities.
In the case of the SCR receiver you're going to be buying, what does SCR stand for?
SDR, Software Defined Radio.
Now I understand. Okay. The SDR is a kind of an interface. It allows you to... What does the SDR give you that you don't now have?
I don't know why, Dick. I have to go over it and over it again. I already went over it 3 times on YouTube. Apparently, you need that in order to use the computer with a spectrum scope. He demonstrates. He shows you where the line is for your VFO. He shows pips up and down the band. You can go over the, put the line from turning the VFO right on that spot, and you'll see who it is. It's better than scanning.
WB2 GXM.
GXM, go ahead.
Hi, Rich. This is Rich. Are you talking about the SDR Play or the SDR Duo? It's the same company. It's from Britain. WB2 GXM.
I don't remember. I gotta go over it again and again. All I know is about $150, and yes, it comes from the UK.
That definitely is the SDR Play. They're actually up to the SDR Play 2. It's version 2. That's the cheaper one. The SDR Duo is about $300. That is a metal case. WB2GXM.
Well, this is what I'm looking forward to buy. Because it comes with software. You have to load that in first. Then you go over and download the free software for the spectrum display. I guess it's an overlay. I don't know.
There is a specific software that converts the SDR Play into a spectrum analyzer. It's still an SDR receiver, but the software is treating it as an analyzer and showing you the spectrum. WB2GXM.
Rich, is this spectrum display really a very fancy large screen pan adapter with other extra indications on there telling you where your VFO is tuned? Go ahead.
Spectrum display software is separate from the standard software that is supposed to turn the SDR into a receiver. The SDR, the software for the receiver is called SDR Sharp, or it can be used with HDR. HDR is the other software that can use the SDR Play. The Spectrum Analyzer software is a special program written by, I don't remember whose name is, one ham wrote the software specifically for this radio, and it converts into a pretty decent spectrum analyzer, WB2GXM.
You've got one of these, GXM, and you like it?
I actually have the first SDR Play, the version 1, which is now obsolete. I can no longer afford to buy these radios. I would love to buy an SDR Duo, which is the $300 model with the metal case, but I've done a lot of research on this. WB2GXM.
Is this a popular device? A lot of hams bought it and are using it, or is only just a few elite guys doing it? Go ahead.
I don't know how many people are using it, but George Thomas mentions it on Amateur Logic TV. I think he also mentioned it in Ham Nation, the video podcast. So he's reaching a lot of hams. He's reaching thousands of hams. So thousands of hams know about the SDR Play and the SDR Duo. This series of SDR receivers is marketed and is marketed by DX Engineering. You can find it in their catalog and online on their website.
Okay, good information. Anything more you want to tell us about, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW?
Just a guy, I have DSAR. The radio I'm on now does DSAR and FM on 2 and 440. DSAR is a very good mode. It's a similar like DMR. It's a lot clearer than DMR because they don't have a slot 1 and a slot 2. It's wider in bandwidth. It's a little mechanical. Not like TMR, which is really mechanical. I like DSAR. I'm going to be getting back on DMR as well. I like technology, Dick. Ever since I got a ham license at the age of 15, I've been building Heath kits and all kinds of stuff. In fact, my graduation present from junior high at the age of 15 was a Heath kit 6-meter radio. It had 17 tubes in it. I spent all summer building it, had one slight problem that I corrected, and I was very proud of myself.
I'm going to ask a pretty dumb question that I should know and I don't know. When you're using D-Star, are you sending a text message or are you sending audio? And if you are sending audio, I think you said the audio sounds good. So if I was transmitting audio over a D-Star radio, what do I get in return as opposed to sending audio in the audio in the ordinary way, Rich? In 2EO, K2IW?
I'm going through a D-Star repeater out here on Long Island. The call letter is NC2EC, Echo Charlie. The good thing about D-Star, you can go around the world. It's international. Once you hit that repeater, you get onto what's called the reflector. They go all around the world, anywhere you want. It's international.
Isn't Echolink also going around the world, and isn't Echolink also international? Over to you, Rich.
Yes, it is. But because I'm not using a radio, myself and many people don't consider Echolink to be real ham radio. That's just an opinion held by myself and many. By the way, you can, with this program I downloaded today, I'm still working on it. It's called D-RAT. D-RAT. It allows you to send communications via text over the D-Star network. It's just like email. You can send messages, receive messages. There's an inbox, an outbox, everything.
Sounds like you're having fun. And too bad somebody doesn't sell the SDR as a kit at a cheaper price. And that SDR that you're thinking of buying for $150, does that cover 80 through 10 meters? And 80 through 10 meters, both on receive and transmit, over to your N2EO, K2IW.
Yes, well, my radio is capable of 160 meters through 6 meters. It'll do everything on every band, doesn't matter.
Dick, the SDR Duo covers 100 hertz to daylight. It is a receiver only.
Okay. What do you gain by using that as a receiver as opposed to the normal receiver that's built into his radio? Go ahead.
Rich and Dick, one really good technique you can use when you get this SDR play, you can use it with all your other radios to turn them all into radios with pan adapters. You just use the SDR to spot the other radios to wherever you want them to be. And this way you will have your eyes on the ham bands, WB2GXM.
Okay. Sounds like fun for people who are into that. We don't have Dr. Roy this weekend, so we're going to go over to Paul for the space report a little bit ahead of schedule. And we might even end a little early tonight, depending on what Paul's got. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Very good. Yeah, Roy's off tonight. It'll be back next week. And this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, we're getting into the season where I see the ISS coming over quite often now. And the program I have shows the different magnitudes. So if I see a pretty bright magnitude, I'll make an announcement on this net. But October 7th would be the next good pass. There's other passes, but October 7th would be good. It's a minus 2.8 magnitude, which is pretty bright. And that will be starting around 7:11 and last to 7:17. And it goes as high as 49 degrees. So that's always a good elevation. And it goes from the northwest to the southeast. So, if I see a couple of them during the week or so, I'll make that announcement. And I use the app. It's a picture of the International Space Station when you look it up. They call it the detector, the ISS detector. Also has other satellites and things, but I just use it for that one particular International Space Station. And you can tell where the Hubble is and all of this, and then if you pay extra money, you can find out where all these thousands of other satellites are. But this is for free. And to me, what's more exciting than looking at the space station as it goes up ahead? I'm assuming it's going to be there for a very long time. There's no talk of deorbiting it. In fact, there's only talk of extending it into the early 2030s. That's my guess. So, okay, last Tuesday, they had a launch at 12 o'clock p.m., and they launched from Kagoshima, Japan. The HTV-8 was delayed for a couple of days, but they finally got it off the pad. Launches on an H-2B rocket. That's the big rocket that Japan uses, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And this is their 8th cargo trip to the International Space Station. That's what they call it, HTV number 8. And after a few days, Saturday, it got there. Got very close to the space station. Christina Koch was the American astronaut. She was in charge of grabbing this thing with her 57-foot robotic arm that Canada built, that's permanently attached to the ISS. And they grabbed all of it, berthed it to the Nadir port looking down on the Harmony module. That's the most forward module right now on the International Space Station. And 16 bolts, got all of it, cranked it all down, they made sure the seal was okay, they opened it up, and they were able to get over 12,000 pounds of stuff. If you ever saw the HTV vehicle, it's a pretty large. It's pretty large. It's 14 feet in diameter, but it's probably about 30 feet or so long. So it's the biggest one that's going up there at this time. They had a bigger one years ago by European Space Agency called the Automatic Transfer Vehicle, ATV, but they've stopped sending those up. They sent 6 of those up over the years, 5 or 6 of them. And but this, they're going to continue to do over the years, roughly one every year. But inside they had EVA equipment. They had batteries. The main thing in the back was with these. They had these. Lithium ion batteries, 6 of them. They're massive things too, hundreds of pounds each, and they take up a lot of room. and they are going to replace the nickel hydrogen batteries that are presently on the International Space Station. Each time it goes up with these batteries, there's six of them, and the six replace 12. So there's four different main solar panels on the space station along the whole truss, which the truss goes as long as a football field. So you have the four sections, and each time at the base of each set of solar cells, they have these batteries, these nickel hydrogen batteries that they're doing away with. They're getting old. They've been up there since the beginning of the space station, and they're replacing them with modern lithium ion batteries. So they're lighter batteries, but they're still big. The nickel metal hydride ones are even bigger, twice the size and twice the weight. The good thing about the lithium ones, it puts out about the same amount of power as the 2-to-1 ratio. So you need these batteries, as the solar panels absorb the light. Happens, of course, it's about 16 times a day. It's going in and out of daylight, so these batteries have to be capable of charging thousands and thousands of times over and over again. So the nickel hydrogen ones, really serve their purpose. They're still working, but their charge is not doing what it used to do in the beginning. So looking forward to that, and there'll be a lot of EVAs to do that job. You'll have quite a few spacewalks to accomplish this. Usually probably around 2 or 3. It's always they go out in a pair, and they'll do that. It's not all that complicated. The robotic arm helps them out. It's a game of pull out one big battery, and each one is as big as a gigantic suitcase. And then relocate that to a temporary storage location and take the new battery and plug it in. Then they have these jumper boxes, which are, big, kind of like empty battery boxes that fill in where the missing ones are going to be. Like I said, they're pulling out 12 and they're putting in 6, so they need these jumper cable setups to fill up those spots. So that's why there's so much work with the EVAs. They've done 2 of these already, two deliveries of sets of batteries. So they've done, south side, starboard side. Starboard side, they've done one section in and all the way out at the very end, as far as you can reach, they've done that. Now they're going to do this one, which is as far as you can reach. Then they have one more section to go after that.
That's tonight at 8 o'clock.
SAY.
Oh, okay. I hear Doug. SAY, go ahead. How you doing? This is Paul, WS2N.
Paul, I'm just going to ask you, what are they going to do with the old batteries? Are they going to leave them up there something to interfere with new spaceships or what?
Yeah, the process has been to take the old batteries and put them back into the HCV cargo vehicle, because they take the HCV cargo vehicle and burn it up over the South Pacific after they're done with everything. The problem is they're bigger and they're much heavier, but not so much with the weight, but the size. They can't take all 12 batteries. Put them into the HTV vehicle. It just doesn't fit. They take out 6 lithiums to install, and they have enough room to take back 9. So they.